Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's just over 2 weeks now until Election Day. But really, this time around, Americans are already deeply into election season. In Harris County, Texas, home to Houston and one of the largest counties in the country, Texans are smashing early voting records. Last Tuesday, the first day of early voting, more than 100,000 people showed up to 122 polling locations around Harris County. But what if you're a Texan that can't wait in line to vote?
Both my wife and I have arthritis problems. Getting around isn't as easy as it used to be. So it's like, let's look at the absentee ballot. And we put in for a yearly absentee ballot. And we always filled it out, returned it, and never gave it a second thought.
That's Ralph Edelbach. He's 82 years old. He lives in Cypress, a Houston suburb. Ralph was just going to pop his ballot in the mail. But then came news about delivery delays with the U.S. Postal Service.
We thought, this is a critical election, and we want to really make sure that our ballots get in and don't have any delays in the mail.
So he decided he would drop off his ballot at one of the 12 designated drop-off locations in Harris County instead.
And the closest one was, I think it was 16 miles away. Not close, but closer than the other ones were. And then the day, I think it was October 1st, when the governor issued his proclamation that only one per county, I saw that and I said, son of a gun, here's another attempt to suppress the vote.
It was October 1st. That was the day Texas Governor Greg Abbott had, in fact, issued a proclamation requiring that mail ballots delivered in person must be dropped off to, quote, a single early voting clerk's office location as publicly designated. All other drop-off sites would be closed. Quote, as we work to preserve Texans' ability to vote during the COVID-19 pandemic, we must take extra care to strengthen ballot security protocols throughout the state, Abbott said. And then he added, these enhanced security protocols will ensure greater transparency and will help stop attempts at illegal voting. Now, Harris County is a Democratic stronghold in Texas, population 4.7 million, almost 1,800 square miles. And now in that area, which, by the way, is 500 square miles larger than Rhode Island, there is one official ballot drop box.
I have to drive like 38 miles to the NRG arena and drop mine off.
Voting rights groups immediately sued to stop Abbott's proclamation in both state and federal court. Ralph is co-plaintiff in one of those suits. And as of Thursday, a Texas judge did strike down Governor Abbott's order. A federal appeals court judge upheld the order in a separate case. And due to all that legal back and forth, the Harris County Clerk's Office says at this time it is not planning on reopening the 11 other Dropbox locations, which means that Ralph, he still has every intention of getting in his car and driving those 38 miles to vote.
If the deadline was hanging right there and it was either not putting my ballot in or either driving myself down there or asking my son-in-law, my son, to drive me down there, I am going to do everything within my power to get my vote in. That's a given.
That's Ralph Edelbach, 82 years old, from Cypress, Texas. So Josh Douglas, Ralph says that this is voter suppression. Is it?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime we're making it harder to participate in our elections for unnecessary means is voter suppression because, you know, the right to vote is the most fundamental, important right in our democracy. And the state really has no good reason to close down the other Dropbox locations. So it is absolutely voter suppression. And unfortunately, the federal appeals court, as you said, upheld the state's designation or determination there.
So Josh Douglas teaches election law, folks, and voting rights at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law, author of Vote for Us, or U.S., How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. So, you know, Professor Douglas, though, from the point of view of the governor, vis-a-vis what he wrote in his proclamation, Governor Abbott did see that there was reason to close the drop boxes. I mean, he's saying two things primarily. One is to protect people due to the pandemic, and two, to ensure, quote, greater transparency and security against voter fraud. So let's take those two in order. First of all, what about the pandemic part? I mean, we talk about how the pandemic has changed everything until we're blue in the face. So why does it not apply in this case?
Well, it does apply to change everything in terms of making it easier to vote, to make it easier to participate, right? You know, we have situations where people are not comfortable going to vote in person. Now, Texas, by the way, has one of the most restrictive rules on that in the country. It's one of only five states that doesn't allow general concerns about COVID-19 to count as a valid excuse to vote via absentee ballot. So they're already restricting who can receive an absentee ballot, and then add on top of that, making it harder for people to drop their ballot off when people are fearing the reliability of the Postal Service because of the politicization of the mails. So it's sort of a multi-pronged attack on people's ability to vote. So if anything, the pandemic should change things to open up access as opposed to restrict it.
And then the governor's assertion that reducing the number of in-person drop box sites helps with transparency and voting integrity, essentially. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the governor doesn't seem to have any evidence that drop boxes harm election integrity. And we know that because there are plenty of other states that have many drop boxes throughout the counties with no integrity concerns. I mean, there's sort of a phantom myth going on that our elections are going to be rigged, that election integrity is a major concern. But it's not clear to me how a secure drop box in a location that has 24-hour surveillance could lead to any sort of voter fraud. And no one has been able to come up with any evidence that it can. So it's kind of absurd to say that the single drop box location can improve election integrity, in my view, when there's zero evidence that the places with multiple drop boxes have no security problems whatsoever.
You know, so Harris County is enormous, right? We were talking about how there's more than 4 million people who live there. It's larger than the state of Rhode Island. Also happens to be a Democratic stronghold because of Houston. But Governor Abbott issued this proclamation that, as far as I understand, applies to the entire state. He's not just targeting Democratic areas. He's reducing the number of county drop boxes everywhere in Texas. So, I mean, to that effect, it's making it harder for everyone to vote, regardless of whether you check D, R, or I on your ballot.
Well, that may be true theoretically until we start thinking about the practical realities on the ground. And this is one thing that I thought was so absurd from that federal appeals court decision that upheld the governor's order, is the court said, you know, everything's equal. Every county can have one drop-off location. But every county's not the same size. It takes someone a lot longer in, you know, Harris County, Houston, to go to the one drop box location than it would in someone in a rural, much smaller county. So it's kind of strange to say, well, this is just equal across the state. We're treating everyone the same when we know that the counties are not the same size, either population-based or geographically. So again, we should really be thinking about how can we improve access. You know, security is important, of course. We need to make sure that we're preventing the kind of voter fraud that we know might occur or plausibly can occur. But there's no suggestion. I just don't understand how multiple Dropbox locations, as long as they have 24-hour surveillance, can pose a problem. And on terms of the equality equation, it's not equal because someone in Harris County, like the named plaintiff that you interviewed, has a much harder time delivering their ballot than someone in a rural county if they want to drop it off in person. And again, this is sort of why we can demonstrate how it's a multi-pronged attack on the right to vote, because we've made it harder, or at least people are concerned, reasonably, given the rhetoric that's occurred about the U.S. Postal Service in terms of delivering their ballot via the mail. And yet we also make it harder to vote in or to drop a ballot off in person as well. Add to that Texas not allowing anyone to vote by mail if they want to with COVID-19 concerns. And we see why Texas is one of the worst states when it comes to the right to vote.
So taking all of those factors in consideration together. Now, let me ask you, though, what about the role of the courts here, because we do have multiple suits, state and federal, with it keeps going back and forth in terms of what the rulings are. But let's take the federal court for a moment here, because I think most recently in the federal side of things, the appeals court upheld the governor's proclamation. So what does that tell you?
Well, that appeals court was a 3-judge panel with all appointees of President Trump. So we're starting to see the effects of both President Trump and Senator Mitch McConnell filling the federal courts as quickly as they can with conservative judges. And what the court did in that case is actually something that appeals courts have done all around the country. They've reversed more favorable decisions from the lower district courts that have eased access, made it easier for people to participate, extended deadlines on absentee ballots for when they can be returned, all in response to the pandemic and in an effort to uphold the constitutional right to vote. And appeals courts have reversed. And there's kind of two principles that the appeals courts have used to reverse those decisions. One is this notion, the so-called Purcell principle, that's named after a U.S. Supreme Court case called Purcell versus Gonzalez, which essentially said that courts shouldn't change the rules too close to an election. And the second principle is that courts basically just defer to the state legislatures and the state election officials on the ground. The courts basically are saying, we're going to stay out of this and let the legislatures and election officials decide how to run an election. Of course, that derogates the right to vote.
So we are talking this hour about the long journey that some ballots have to take in order to be counted. It's being called voter suppression in several places, and we've been talking about Texas. We'll take a look at Georgia and California as well. So Josh Douglas, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the long journey that some ballots need to take to get counted in 2020. We're taking a look at Texas. We'll be talking about Georgia and California as well. Joshua Douglas joins us. He's election law and voting rights professor at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law and author of Vote For Us. Josh, is it Vote For Us or U.S.? I want to get it right.
Well, either one works okay for me, but I call it Vote For Us.
Vote For Us, because it's capital U, capital S. Okay, Vote For Us, How to Take
it's,
Back.
It's a double meaning on purpose.
I got it. This is on radio. It's harder to communicate that double entendre, okay? So Vote For Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. So we talked about what's happening in Texas regarding ballot drop boxes, official ballot drop boxes there. Let's turn our attention for a moment to Georgia, because just last week we spoke with Nicole Guidotti Hernandez. She is a professor of English and faculty affiliate in women's studies at Emory University. And last Monday, she voted for the first time in Georgia.
When I got to the building, there were already 50 people inside. The poll workers were frantically moving around, trying to get people in order, trying to maintain social distance. What was not a welcome sight was a series of what I saw as hoops designed to deter voters.
First hoop, Guidotti Hernandez said she had to fill out a form to verify her identity.
Then there was a second verification of that form, this time using a computer system that was then verified, uploaded. I had to sign and verify yet again that I was who I was, that I live at the address that I do, and I was handed a chip card.
And when she thought she had finally successfully cast her ballot with the chip card?
Instead of electronically uploading my ballot gets printed out with a QR code,
which she then had to take to an electronic drop box.
The first lockbox that we tried did not work, and the poll worker there was very nervous and said, try it in this other one. This one's not working. And so it finally went through.
Well, Nicole Guidotti-Hernandez says that all of these steps are especially notable, considering concerns regarding exposure to COVID-19 and the fact that each step prolongs the voting process in Georgia. Some voters have taken to calling it a poll tax on their time. Well, joining us now is Theodore Johnson. He's a senior fellow and director of the Fellows Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Ted Johnson, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So about these steps that Nicole said she had to go through in order to cast her ballot at a polling place in Georgia, how unusual are those?
So it's in the course of U.S. history, it's not unusual at all. I mean, I think since the inception of the nation, complicating access to the polls have been how candidates and parties, campaigns have tried to shape the electorate to be more in their favor. And all of the political research shows that for every hurdle you place in front of a person's access to the ballot, you reduce the amount of people that successfully cast a ballot. So whether it's time, registration concerns, voter ID concerns, all of these things, even distance of the poll station from a person's residence, all of these things serve to reduce the number of people who participate in elections. And when these things are tailored in a way to target those communities that don't help the person with power and detract against that person's competitor, then you shape the electorate in a way that entrenches you and your party in power and disenfranchises voting eligible people for no other reason than winning elections.
Last week, we spoke to a Georgian who said she'd waited 10 hours in line to cast her ballot, in part because there were machine malfunctions as well. So can I just ask you briefly about that QR code that's being printed out on Georgia ballots? If I understand correctly, and do correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't want to put forth any misinformation, but there's a QR, you put in your vote, a QR code gets printed out, and I think next to the QR code, there's like also a typewritten list of who you voted for, but it's the computer that scans the QR code. So can, I guess voters are wondering, can they be confident that what's on the QR code is actually who they voted for?
Well, I hope so. a lot of these little measures are supposed to make things more secure, incorporate technology. But what they really do, one, is introduce doubt to the voter on whether or not their votes are being counted the right way. But it's another way of sort of voter suppression works in a number of ways. And one of the ways is convincing people or putting doubt in the minds in people's minds about the legitimacy of the process and the integrity of the process. The caller or the person mentioned that the poll worker was quite nervous. And I think that's right. Poll workers aren't always trained on the equipment or the processes that are put in front of them, but they mostly want to do the right thing and want to do the right job. So it's not like, I would say, it's not like these measures are put in place intentionally to stumble people from the top of government all the way down. The last thing I will say is that these measures are usually put in place and explained as a way of preventing voter fraud. Mm-hmm. But at the Brennan Center for Justice, we found that the incidence of voter fraud is 0.0025%, which means it's about the likelihood of a person being hit by a meteor at some point in their life. So all of these extra measures are being put in place to prevent something that hardly ever happens, and in the process complicates the access to the polls, and again shapes the electorate in ways that are favorable to those who hold power.
Josh Douglas, did you want to comment on that?
Well, first, I didn't realize the chance of me being hit by a meteorite was that high. So I got to process that. But, you know, one thing we're seeing from the storylines is these extremely long lines and this voter engagement, which is great. But that shouldn't obscure the fact that we have voter suppression, right? That just because we might have historic turnout this year, which I hope we do, doesn't mean that voters haven't had to jump through unnecessary hoops. And anytime we're making it harder to vote for no good reason is one time too many. You know, if the right to vote is the most foundational, fundamental right in our democracy, then why are we burdening it so much for, you know, that tiny possibility of rooting out some kind of phantom voter fraud that we know doesn't actually exist?
What do you think? I'm going to step away from this QR code issue for a second, but I'm kind of obsessed with it also, because, you know, ostensibly we look to technology to actually help with these situations, to make it easier to vote as long as we can guarantee its security. And I imagine that Georgia elections officials say, well, like, these QR codes then perhaps reduce the possibility of mismarked ballots or something like that. So, I mean, Ted, what do you think about that?
I mean, that's a valid point. I mean, if you're relying on people to circle in a bubble and they put an X or a check mark, the QR code ostensibly makes that, you know, less likely to happen. Also, especially in a time of coronavirus, the less touching that needs to happen. You know, there are a lot of restaurants now that are using QR codes for their menus instead of giving you a menu. So if there's less touching of ballots involved, or, you know, by using machines to run the ballots and not having a ton of passing of paper or materials between poll workers and voters, okay, potentially that's a little bit safer. But let's weigh what we're gaining here with what we're losing. And if you're detracting people from voting, if you're causing them to wait in line 12 hours just to participate in our democracy, you're probably complicating the process more than you're helping, even in a public health sense. Keeping a person sequestered in a poll area for half a day is not making them safer from the coronavirus, for sure.
Josh, did you want to comment?
Well, this, I think, brings in again what I mentioned earlier about the courts deferring so much to the state legislature. In the case involving Georgia's voting machines, the district court basically said that because of the concerns about unreliability and the testing of these machines, that some people's votes might be suppressed, essentially, that there would be a violation. But the district court said, I'm bound by U.S. Supreme Court and the appellate court precedent, which says that I have to defer to the state legislature and the state election officials. So again, we're seeing the attack from all different angles. And it was really striking to me to read that judge's very thorough decision, which basically said, I have very strong concerns about these machines and protecting the right to vote, but my hands are tied because I'm being told by the higher courts I have to defer to the state legislature and the state election officials on the ground. You know, what happened to courts protecting the constitutional right to vote?
Well, we're going to circle back to the court's role here, but I want to just take a turn briefly to California as well, because we talked about Texas, Georgia, now California, because last week, the California Secretary of State and Attorney General sent a cease and desist order to the California GOP, asking them to remove unauthorized ballot boxes that were set up by the state Republican Party. Some of those boxes had been marked official, but on Friday, the state backed away from those legal threats after the California GOP agreed that it would not place the drop boxes outdoors, would not leave them unattended, or present them as official. So joining us now from Sonoma, California, is Harmeet Dhillon, GOP committee woman from California and founder of the Dhillon Law Group and Center for American Liberty. Harmeet Dhillon, welcome to you.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, tell me, why were these drop boxes put out initially by the California GOP?
Well, in California, we've had a law since 2016 passed by Democrats who control our state called ballot harvesting. And so in California, unlike many other states, ballot harvesting, that is a stranger coming door to door or otherwise collecting people's ballots and turning them in within 72 hours, is state law. And the reason for that is, it's kind of interesting what your prior speakers are talking about, making it easier to vote. We personally, as Republicans, don't agree with ballot harvesting. We believe that the voting process is most secure when the voter turns in the ballot or the voter votes in person. My personal preference is that. However, because it is legal since 2016, It is legal for paid or unpaid workers to come to your door and collect your ballot. It is legal for volunteers or paid staffers to collect them at places like a union hall or a church or a PTA meeting or some other place where people gather and turn them in. So in this election cycle, Republicans are doing it. And because of COVID, you know, we don't want people going door to door and knocking on doors. And, you know, we think that's a sort of way of more intrusive. So we have set out boxes or secure receptacles and they're locked. They have like a mail slot, like you see some old fashioned mm-hmm. ballot boxes, and you can drop the ballot in there. And so what Democrats are upset about, and the Secretary of State and the Attorney General are both quite partisan, former legislators, is that we're doing it. There are no concerns when Democrats have been doing it. But our state law is very vague. It does not provide for where you put the ballots. It does not provide for who can collect the ballots. A felon can collect them. An illegal alien can collect them. Somebody from another state can collect them. The only requirement is you turn them in if you're collecting other people's ballots within 72 hours. And we're doing that. So that's really what the controversy is, that it's a partisan controversy. Democrats are fine with Democrats doing it. They don't like Republicans doing it.
So there's a couple of details there, which I hope we can sort out. Because my understanding was that for, to use the term ballot harvesting, for those ballots that were collected by other individuals, that individual had to sign the ballot, right?
I mean, and that's actually not part of the law. So that's one of the okay. very interesting things that should be fixed if people think that's important. The only law that this is why the press says the Secretary of State backed off. They backed off because they don't have a legal claim. There is a requirement to the registrars of voters that there be a line placed on the envelopes of the ballots for somebody to sign if they're collecting them. But there is no commensurate requirement on the collector to sign them. And there's also a law in 2018 that these same folks that are complaining now push through that eliminated that signature requirement effectively by saying that if there's no signature, it doesn't matter. We're going to count the ballot anyway. And so in some counties, we've just found in Contra Costa County here in the Bay Area, which is a suburb of San Francisco, there's no signature line on the ballot. So it's impossible for anybody to even sign a ballot in that entire county. And I'm sure that's true in some other counties as well.
Okay. This is so interesting because, I mean, if over in each one of these states, it is the letter of the law in the local in that state that that the suits and the countersuits and the legal threats are all hinging on. So from what I understand, okay, Harmeet, I'm looking at the elections code here from California, various sections, section 3011A, subsection A, subsection 11. And this is the one that says a designee must include a signature on the return vote by mail envelope as the person authorized to return the ballot, along with providing the name and relationship to the voter. And then I note, though, that the California GOP General Counsel noted that there's a subdivision of that law that says a ballot shall not be disqualified solely because the person authorized to return it did not provide identification on the envelope. Is that what you're referring to?
That's right. Those two are contradictory. So, by the way, the state party is signing the ballots. So, but the controversy again here is that our state law does not say who signs the ballot. Okay. So there may be one person who collects the ballot. In the case of the Democratic side, it might be a union worker who comes to your door and collects it. That isn't necessarily the same person who drops it off at the registrar of voters within 72 hours. And so that's another lack of clarity in the law, who signs it. It could be one person who takes it from you, a different person who drops it off. So we've told the government that we believe the correct thing to do is the person who drops it off should be the person who signs that they're dropping it off.
So a couple more quick questions, if I could. Then what I think the part of this controversy was tipped off because, as far as I understand, I mean, and we've seen pictures, that some of these boxes were initially marked official when they were not. Why did that happen?
Yeah, that is a mistake by a volunteer, and it affected a handful of boxes for less than 24 hours. And when the state party was made aware of that issue, we immediately corrected it. So That's a non-issue. And I want to add that in California, unlike some of these other states I've heard, sounds like it may be very complicated to vote in some places. And, you know, there's a tension between ease of voting and security of voting, in my opinion. But in California, the Secretary of State has set up a methodology where, by the way, we have universal vote by mail in California this year, where you can supposedly track your ballot. So if somebody is concerned that somehow there's some plot by the Republican Party to collect your ballot and, you know, tear it up and throw it into the ocean, well, you can check where it is. You can check that the mail has been processed if you dropped it in the mail. You can check when it arrived at the registrar of voters of one of 58 counties in California. And you can check when the ballot was counted. So all of that can be done on the Secretary of State's website.
Well, Harmeet Dhillon, GOP committeewoman for the state of California, with us from Sonoma, California. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Josh Douglas and Ted Johnson, stand by. We'll talk more about voting in 2020 when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking about the long journey that some ballots have to take to actually get to the ballot box in 2020. AKA voter suppression in some places. Now, we did actually hear from several On Point listeners who said this year they had very positive experiences voting. And here's what they said.
Everybody received a ballot in the mail. You can fill that ballot out and mail it back, or you can do what I did, which was filled out the ballot at my leisure in my own home, took it down to my town hall down the road, dropped it into the ballot box.
We did the mail in. I very early on called the county clerk's office. The county clerk's office, even though they are the opposite party of what I'm registered, they were incredibly helpful.
Voted a couple weeks ago just by going to the town office and filling out my ballot, and it was quick and easy.
So several On Point listeners there with their quick and easy efforts in voting in 2020. I'm joined today by Josh Douglas. He's election law and voting rights professor at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law, author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Ted Johnson joins us as well. He's senior fellow and director of the Fellows Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. And Josh and Ted, I want to just get your responses to the California case that we talked about before the break with Harmeet Dhillon. So she was saying a couple of interesting things there. First of all, that California has all vote by mail this year and the ability for people to ostensibly track their ballots. So basically downplaying concern about who collects the ballots and how they get to the counting facilities. You just, Josh, your first response to that?
Well, ballot tracing is really important, and virtually every state that has a lot of mail-in balloting, including the states that have adopted it this year because of the pandemic, are also doing ballot tracing. But I think to the broader point, and it kind of goes to those voters that we just heard from in terms of the ease of voting, we know how to do this well, right? We have, I'm guessing those voters were from states like Oregon or Colorado or Utah, where they may automatically mail everyone a ballot, make it easy for people to return it, have ballot tracing that, you know, as the one from California noted, improves the security of the system. So we know how to do this. And to me, you know, maybe it's just me, but I think that election should be won by the best candidates and the best ideas with everyone voting instead of the election rules. But unfortunately, in some states, election rules have an outsized importance.
Mm. Okay, so Ted, there's another specific thing about the California situation that I wanted to hear from you guys on. And that is, I mean, this phrase ballot harvesting, that apparently people can go door to door or in churches or wherever and collect voters' ballots. And as long as they sign them, or I guess maybe even not sign the back of them, can take them to, you know, elections or counting facilities. Is that a good idea? Because I guess in the California case, we're seeing that, you know, is it open to exploitation, manipulation? I don't know.
Yeah, so I think it's all about motivations. I mean, first, if you are collecting ballots at, say, a nursing home or an elderly care facility, that's probably a good thing to do, because the likelihood of those voters being able to make it to the polls and wait in lines, et cetera, may not be there. Even mail may not be as reliable in some of these facilities. And so having someone that can harvest votes, and by this I mean collect legitimately cast votes, may not be a bad thing. But the issue, though, and I think your previous guest mentioned this, is that when the parties begin to weaponize the method of voting, then we miss the part about making it easier for people to participate. We overplay the incidence of fraud in these types of ballot measure or ways of collecting ballots. And then the conversation gets away from the fact that we're actually creating a more participatory democracy by giving people multiple means of participating, and instead bicker about which side is cheating or which side is, you know, playing by a set of rules that they're not extending to the other. So whether it's a good idea or not is really about effective leadership and the messages they're communicating to the public. But in my view, is universal suffrage means you should help people universally participate. And if ballot harvesting is a legal way of doing so, then the method in and of itself shouldn't be that controversial.
Mm. So let's take a step back here, because I think one of the – maybe 2020, as it has been in all things, is this mirror that focuses and sharpens our understanding and sort of like underlying truths about this country. And Josh, one of the things you said earlier was that the courts – in several cases we're seeing are basically deferring to the discretion of local elections officials. And is that not the right thing to do, Josh? Because we really ultimately, at the end of the day, that is those are the people who have the greatest power in elections, the local or state level officials. That's the way the system is set up.
Yeah, but it's a little strange when we allow partisan election officials to dictate the rules under which we run our elections when they very well may be self-interested. You know, we saw this a few years ago in Georgia when Brian Kemp, then the Secretary of State, was running the election in which he was also running for governor. And, you know, obviously there's essentially a conflict of interest. And we're the only modern democracy that has partisan officials run our elections. You know, we could do this where we had nonpartisan professional election administrators who wouldn't at least have the appearance of self-interest. Now, I'm not trying to derogate local election officials. They're doing a great job, an impossible task in many cases, with too few resources, made even more difficult with the pandemic. So I'm not trying to suggest that everyone here is trying to rig the system in a particular way. However, if we have a constitutional right to vote enshrined in our democracy, then we need some sort of check on especially state legislatures that might craft rules not to make voting as easy as possible or to sustain our democracy so much, but instead to make it easier for them to stay in power. We call this entrenchment. And so there's got to be a check there. We can't just defer to state legislatures when the majority might be trying to essentially change the rules to keep themselves in the majority.
So since you mentioned if we have a constitutional right to vote, let's get the constitutional law 101 on that. Does the Constitution affirmatively grant the right to vote to Americans over a certain age?
No, this is something that I've written extensively about. The right to vote is mentioned several times in the U.S. Constitution, but it's mostly in the negative. Various constitutional amendments say no state could deny the right to vote on the basis of race or sex or age over 18 or inability to pay a poll tax. And the U.S. Supreme Court has even said in, for example, the Bush v. Gore case from 2000, that the Constitution does not confer the right to vote, that states can grant it. And once they do, they have to treat everyone equally. And so the U.S. Supreme Court has used the Equal Protection Clause to protect the right to vote. And unfortunately, in my view, this has led to a jurisprudence that is very restrictive on voting rights. You know, because we have a court that is going to be much more conservative and very textualist, I think we're seeing the reason to have a new constitutional amendment that affirmatively grants the right to vote, because right now the courts are very restrictively viewing it and thereby deferring to the states.
Ted, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, and so, and I agree with everything. And the issue is now you get this sort of patchwork voting rights existence in the United States, where in states like Maine and Vermont, if you're in prison, you can vote from there. But in states like Florida, if you're convicted of a felony, you lose your right to vote, period, unless the governor pardons it. And even after the people of Florida said, no, we want those folks re-enfranchised, the state government blocked it. And, you know, in places like Wyoming, you don't have to show voter ID. But in places like Texas, if you have a government-issued ID from the university system, that's no good. But if you have a gun license from the state, that is good. And so now, depending on what state you live in, you can access your right to vote in different ways, and it's complicated in different ways. An affirmative right to vote in the Constitution would require some sort of baselining, aside from being 18, to participate in the elections. And without that baselining, states can sort of play around with the electorate in ways that they feel necessary to retain power.
Yeah. You know, there are so many.
And Megan, can I
add go ahead, Josh. Yeah.
On that, because I think it's really important. You know, you mentioned the Texas example with the photo ID law. And, you know, people say everything's bigger in Texas, and I think voter suppression is as well. But an affirmative right to vote might, you know, at least help the courts police that a little more. Now, every right. state constitution actually does have a right to vote. Well, I say every 49 of the 50 state constitutions explicitly confer the right to vote. Only Arizona's doesn't, although the state courts in Arizona have construed its state constitution as conferring the right to vote. So we actually do have protection within the state constitutions and state courts a need to robustly protect that. However, there's a case right now pending before the U.S. Supreme Court out of Pennsylvania, a decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court about the state constitution. And if the U.S. Supreme Court intervenes there, it's going to usher in a whole new realm of the U.S. Supreme Court looking at state constitutions and their protection for the right to vote, which is kind of absurd because we would think that the state Supreme Court's should have the final say on state constitutions. So again, we have a model in state constitutions. We just need to encourage courts to use them, which many courts have done.
Mm. So there have been so many ways in which 2020 and its various threads come to this or end up in this place where there is a dire need, I think, to modernize the civic infrastructure of this country, on the civic and legal infrastructure of this country. And so, Josh, I was very taken by your example. And is it theoretical? Like, are there countries out there that have nonpartisan elections officials that run their elections?
Yeah, I mean, we could look at the United Kingdom, for example, which has an electoral commission that runs elections. Now, you know, one of the things that's important to emphasize that you just mentioned is the local control of elections. And in some ways, I think there's some benefit to having experimentation at the local level. You know, imagine, for example, that we had a national election commission that required every state to use the butterfly ballot that Palm Beach County used in 2000 that caused so much confusion. Right? That was a problem when one county, imagine nationwide that problem. That said, I think local experimentation makes sense to try out different election reforms, like ranked choice voting, for example, where instead of choosing one candidate, the voters can rank order their favorite candidates according to their preference. And that started at the local level and has now spread. And now Maine, for example, is using it for presidential electors. So I'm not sure that we need necessarily a nationwide election commission, but I do think we need to have nonpartisan election officials who run our elections. It just makes no sense to have a Democrat or Republican running the rules of the game. It's like, you know, I'm a big baseball fan, and it's like in the World Series coming up with the Dodgers and the Rays, the Dodgers get to choose the umpire that is a Dodgers fan one day, and the Rays get to choose a Rays fan to be the umpire the next day. It just makes no sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm always supportive of it. Of efforts to sort of smash the hardened accretions that form due to tradition and habit. So just to underscore, the UK, other countries, they have nonpartisan elections officials that run their elections. That exists in places elsewhere.
That does exist in other places.
Okay, because I'm not being jokey. I really do think it's important here is to imagine what the other possibilities are, especially if we're not really even imagining them, if they're real, to just train our minds on what else is possible. So Ted, let me ask you, what would in order to reduce the kinds of voter suppression that you and Josh have been describing to us through the hour, where else would you focus your efforts?
Yeah. So, you know, the civil rights activist Reverend William Barber has said that Jim Crow didn't die. He just went to law school and became James Crow Esquire. So a lot of the voter suppression fights we're seeing today are happening in the courts because where states, localities are using rules, regulations, statute in order to, keep people out of the polls in ways that appear colorblind with universal application, but have a very different sort of effect. So a few things. I think, one, the mechanics of voting we can make easier and just sort of accept that that should be the standard in the United States. One of the things that we push for at the Brennan Center is automatic voter registration. When I turned 18, I was automatically registered for the military draft, but not to vote. That shouldn't be the case. Citizenship requires both willingness to serve your country and to participate in its democracy. So registering voters automatically helps reduce the hurdle of registration that some states are putting forward. And another, you know, there are other broader measures like increased civic education. But what I would like to see to some respect is like a disparate impact sort of standard. This used to be kind of the case prior to Shelby County v. Holder in the Supreme Court in 2013, which gutted a essential part of the Voting Rights Act of 65, which essentially stated that states that had a history of racial discrimination in their voting practices had to go to the federal government for preclearance before they can make any changes. And the 2013 Shelby County decision gutted that requirement. And in the last decade, 25 states have put in new voter restrictive measures as a result. And so I think the federal government sort of requiring some sort of disparate impact standard that would require states to show that whatever they put in place is not going to discriminate against one group or another unfairly. And certainly if it does, it needs to be a really high standard in order to get that thing passed, should be the norm for how we do things, along with independent redistricting commissions, ensuring the census is completed fully and accurate counts are done, et cetera. It's a massive fundamental reform for our democracy that's required if we want it to be truly inclusive, universal, and participatory.
Well, Ted Johnson, since you mentioned Selective Service, I should also mention that Ted is a retired commander from the United States Navy. He served for two decades, including as a White House Fellow, a professor at the U.S. Naval College, and a speechwriter to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He's now Senior Fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Ted Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Josh Douglas, election law and voting rights professor at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law, author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Professor Douglas, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.